An Overview of Jesus' Ministry by Robert C. Newman, Biblical Theological Seminary. This is a sketch outline of Jesus' earthly ministry, fitting some of the various incidents into a chronological structure. As introductory remarks, we'll mention here that there is some disagreement on the length of Jesus' ministry. Liberal interpreters have often put it down at around 1 year. Evangelical and other Orthodox interpreters have generally put it as 2 to 3 years or 3 to 4 years, depending on whether one takes a remark of Jesus in his incident in John 4, where he just talked to the Samaritan woman, where he says, don't you say there's still 3 months till harvest, talking to the disciples. And if one takes that literally, that at the time he said that there were still 3 months to harvest, you tend to be pushed into a 3 to 4 year scheme on that particular arrangement. There's also some disagreement on the date of the crucifixion, and the earliest common dates are around AD 29 and the latest around AD 33. My inclination at the moment is to favor around AD 30, that's the spring of AD 30, for his crucifixion, though there is some warrant for thinking that the later date is a good possibility as well. Well, we're going to give you a tour then, an outline, if you like, of Jesus' life and ministry, and in this we'll follow the subdivisions used by Guthrie in his book, A Shorter Life of Christ, that's Donald Guthrie, which he subdivides this way, 30 years in Nazareth, so that's before his ministry begins, period of preparation, early Judean ministry, the Galilean ministry, and the closing period, and then the passion and resurrection. So we're going to follow that kind of scheme here in walking through this outline of Jesus' life and ministry. 30 years in Nazareth, we of course have John's prologue, which goes back far earlier than that, to Jesus' pre-existence, his deity, his incarnation. Then we have the birth narratives, which occur in Matthew and Luke, and they speak of Jesus' virginal conception and his birth then at Bethlehem. And then Matthew, in this material, gives us, I believe, Joseph's perspective. If you look at Matthew set in contrast to Luke, you'll see that Matthew narrates for us Joseph's reaction to Mary's pregnancy and the dream that he receives to encourage him to go ahead and accept Mary as his wife, and then the warnings to escape from Herod, if you like. Matthew also has the visit of the wise men, the Magi, and such. Luke, on the other hand, has Mary's perspective. We have the Annunciation to Mary and her visit to Elizabeth, and the shepherds coming at the birth, etc. And given that Matthew has Joseph's perspective and Luke has Mary's perspective, it's my guess, and the guess of a number of commentators, but this is again disputed, that the two genealogies in Matthew and Luke gives us Joseph's genealogy in Matthew and Mary's genealogy in Luke, although, of course, putting Joseph in as the one who is the reputed father, if you like. That would explain a number of things. One, the two genealogies are different. Two, they're both Davidic. Three, the Matthew genealogy is along the royal line, but that royal line has been cursed in Jeremiah, whereas Mary's line, and Jesus is obviously a physical descendant of Mary and an adopted descendant of Joseph, perhaps suggests one way in which the virgin birth functions to avoid the curse that God places upon the royal line in Jeremiah. A curse, by the way, which implies just a few verses later that that there still will be a Messiah. We move on then in our tour of the 30 years in Nazareth, John's prologue, the birth narratives, and then Jesus at age 12, the only picture we really have of Jesus growing up, if you like, and this particular picture is a hint of things to come as well. Jesus, already in his human knowledge, recognizes God as his father and says to his mother, Mary, didn't you expect me to be in my father's house? We move on then to the period of preparation, and Here we see some insight into the John the Baptist and his person and message, and then the baptism of Jesus, John's reluctance to baptize Jesus. What does John know of Jesus? Well, according to a harmonization of the Gospels, he doesn't yet at that point know that Jesus is the Messiah, because the dove has not come down on him yet. But he's a pretty close relative of Jesus and may have grown up with him and felt of all people that he knew that Jesus needed to repent less than anyone else did. In any case, heaven is opened, the dove comes down, and John comes to realize that Jesus is this one that he had been told would come, the one who he was not worthy to untie the sandals of. The narration then moves on to the temptation of Jesus, which is narrated for us in Matthew and Luke and just mentioned in Mark. It is of help here, I think, to compare the temptations of Adam and Eve to the temptation of Jesus. Adam and Eve are tempted in a garden. Jesus is tempted in a wilderness. Jesus is tempted in the wilderness because Adam and Eve messed up the world, if you like, by their failing in their particular temptation, so that there's some sense in which the world becomes a wilderness. Also, a comparison, I think, to be kept in mind of Israel in the wilderness and their temptation, which they fail rather badly as well, if you look through the narratives of Israel in the wilderness. And we know from the Gospel of Matthew that Jesus is thinking about Israel in the wilderness during his temptation, because the three passages he quotes in response to Satan's temptation are, in fact, Israel in the wilderness passages. Well, Jesus does not fail his temptation, and so he is able to be the one who is going to redeem mankind. We move on to Jesus' early Judean ministry. This is found only in the Gospel of John. We see Jesus' first contact with the future disciples, which perhaps helps explain a little bit of the sense in why when Jesus walks along the seashore later in the Synoptic Gospels, that they're ready to leave everything and follow Jesus. That's not been their first contact with him. We also have in John the wedding at Cana, and there we see something of Jesus' miraculous powers, the first sign of that, if you like. Obviously, his parents know something of who he is, but his disciples don't know much at that particular point. And there's perhaps some symbolic significance as well, that Jesus is the one who turns the occasion there into one of sorrow, because there's no wine, into one of joy, and turning the water into wine. And the fact that it's a wedding feast, etc., all perhaps have some resonances with Old Testament background and perhaps point us forward to the wedding feast of the Lamb as well. It's John also that in chapter 3 contains the conversation with Nicodemus, where we see that Jesus is one who is able to instruct even the major theologians, the major rabbis. Jesus' conversation with the Samaritan woman, a hint that he's reaching out beyond Israel, and that he is indeed the Messiah. He says something along those lines to the Samaritan woman in a clearer way than he generally does to the Jews as well. Then we come to Jesus' Galilean ministry. Jesus' ministry is largely up north in Galilee, and therefore largely on the Jewish side of Galilee, that is the west side and northwest and southwest of the Sea of Galilee, as we see in our map there. This is subdivided by Guthrie into periods. The early part of the Galilean ministry up to the choosing of the 12, and then from there on to the withdrawal northward out of Galilee, and then from there down to Jesus' last journey to Jerusalem. So we'll discuss it in those periods as well. To the choosing of the 12, we begin with the initial call of the disciples there by the seashore, where Peter, Andrew, James, and John begin to follow Jesus. Then we have Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, narrated for us in Matthew 5 through 7, and either a similar sermon or perhaps a different description of the same sermon in the so-called Sermon on the Plain in Luke. We then have a sequence of healing and other miracles, And then some sketch of the popularity and criticism of Jesus. We see a polarization beginning already in this early part of the Galilean ministry. And finally, then at the end of this section, the choosing of the 12. So Jesus now selects out 12 immediate major disciples using the term apostles, a term which existed already in Greek, not a term that Jesus invents. And it represents a stronger term than disciples. Disciples are learners, students. Apostles are messenger, a little different than angelos. A commissioner might be a closer term. A person who has a commission from some higher authority that gives the person who's the apostle a certain authority and certain decision-making that a messenger would not have. From the choosing of the 12 to the withdrawal northward, Guthrie gives these headings, Sabbath controversies and healings. We begin to see something of the fact that Jesus is very strongly objected to by the Pharisees, particularly because of his behavior on the Sabbath does not fit what they feel ought to be done on the Sabbath, and that involves some actions and healings particularly. We begin to see some divisions of the people then, even some divisions in the Pharisees and attacks against Jesus. We get some samples of Jesus' teaching. Matthew gives these in big blocks, starting with the Sermon on the Mount. Luke gives them a little bit more scattered than that, and Mark does as well. We see a picture of the unbelief at Nazareth, that Jesus coming to his own hometown is rejected by them, not initially, but after he says some things that suggest that the Jews are not going to be especially favored, in some sense, with the ministry of Jesus. We then have the feeding of the 5,000, which obviously recalls to the people there the activity of Moses in connection with the manna, and excites people's interest in the whole question of, is this the Messiah, and look how he could lead us against the Romans, since he can supply food, it could not be cut off from your food supply, etc. Jesus turns down the offers to become king, and sends away the disciples, and then after the crowd is gone, he comes to them in the middle of the night, walking on the water, and that certainly an astonishing thing to the disciples. Who is this that can do these sorts of things? We also have some controversy here of Jesus' relationship to the tradition of the elders. Moving on from there, the section from there to the Jesus' last journey to Jerusalem, Jesus moved now into Gentile territory, and reasoning for that, I think probably largely that he needs to teach his disciples, and that things are heating up fast enough in Galilee that there will be some kind of confrontation if Jesus continues to stay in there. So he moves up into Gentile territory. Here we have a narration also with the feeding of the 4,000, which appears to be more on Gentile ground than the feeding of the 5,000 was. And some have suggested perhaps the gathering of crowds to him in the Gentile territory is a spinoff of the demoniac that he had rescued from the demons. Remember, the demons were sent into the pigs, who seems to have been a Gentile. It's this time that we have Peter's confession of recognition that Jesus is the Messiah, and Jesus' encouragement of Peter and of the disciples, and then telling them to not to be spreading this around at this point. The narratives move on to Jesus' transfiguration, where we see Jesus with Moses and Elijah, and the very important remarks from heaven there, the second of the voices from heaven, if you like, the first of Jesus' baptism. Now, this one indicating that Jesus is beyond the league of Elijah and Moses. More miracles narrated in this particular period of time, and also more sayings of Jesus. And that brings us finally to the closing period. Luke has a whole section in his gospel that is only perhaps hinted at in John and not really done much of anything with in Matthew and Mark at all, what we call the Perean ministry section, that Jesus had a ministry across the Jordan River between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea, an area that had been repopulated by Jews at the Maccabean period, and so Jesus has ministry over there as well. There on the map you can see Perea, which I've outlined with the with a ellipse. In this section, we have Jesus moving toward Jerusalem, indication that Jesus leaves his Galilean ministry and is moving towards a final ministry in Jerusalem, but spends apparently several months in Perea during this time. Then the narration moves on to the journey into Jerusalem and Jesus' ministry in Jerusalem. Moving toward Jerusalem, we have something of Jesus' movement from Galilee to Bethany, some teaching on prayer, some more teaching on parables, some more encounters with the Pharisees, Jesus at two Jewish feasts, indication that the Perean ministry wasn't just a gradual travel down to Jerusalem, but into that area and then over to Jerusalem and then back out to Perea, etc. Again, Jesus dining with the Pharisees, and Jesus addressing the crowds. We then see some more parables for the Pharisees, teaching for the disciples, another clash with the Pharisees, Jesus teaching about service, his healing of the 10 lepers, and sayings about the kingdom and the future. Luke's material in this Perean section seems kind of miscellaneous in some sense compared to Matthew and Mark. And I think part of the reason here is that, Jesus' ministry was perhaps repeated somewhat in a number of different locations in Perea, and perhaps Luke had interviewed people in those regions to get information about what Jesus had to say here. This continues with two parables on prayer, and then Jesus' trip over into the Jerusalem area where he raises Lazarus. Continuing on still with our journey into Jerusalem, we have the conclusion of the Perean ministry, which Jesus deals with the questions of divorce, his relationship to children, his conversation with the rich young ruler, the parable of the vineyard workers, and then now Jesus moving towards Jerusalem comes to Jericho. Here we have the healing of the blind man and the conversion of Zacchaeus. The blind man incident is rather interesting in that Luke has it taking place going into Jericho, and Matthew and Mark have it taking place going out of Jericho. And I think the best explanation of that is that at New Testament times, there were two Jerichos. There was the Old Jericho on the site of Old Testament Jericho, and this seems to be mentioned by Matthew and Mark. And then there was a recently built-up area where a number of the wealthy people had their mansions, if you like. That was the new Jericho, and that Jesus heals these blind men, leaving the old Jericho and heading for the new Jericho, where Luke is going to narrate the conversion of Zacchaeus. We then have Jesus at Bethany on the Mount of Olives, and here takes place the anointing by Mary. And then we move into the ministry in Jerusalem, beginning with the triumphal entry. Jesus cursing of the fig tree, the attempts to trap Jesus into saying something that would be disastrous, Jesus' Olivet Discourse, which on the Mount of Olives, he answers the question of when this temple will be destroyed, not one stone left on another, and what will be the sign of his coming in the end of the age. We move then into Jesus' Passion and Resurrection, where the Gospels narrate the plot to kill Jesus, and then the Last Supper, Jesus' arrest in the garden, the trials of Jesus, a preliminary hearing of some sort before Annas, a more formal hearing before Caiaphas with probably at least a rump or at least some portion of the Sanhedrin, maybe even a quorum. We don't know the details on how that functioned. That all at night. And then apparently a more formal trial near sunrise the next morning, and then his trial before Pilate. The Roman trial, and then you remember Jesus is sent off by Pilate to Herod, and then sent back. And now we have some narration of the events on the way to the cross after Pilate has announced his death penalty, death sentence. The incident of Simon Cyrene being, what should we say, drafted into carrying the cross. The weeping of the women at Jerusalem, and Jesus' remarks about weep for themselves for what's going to come on Jerusalem. We then have the narration of Jesus on the cross, the inscription over his head, the thieves, the soldiers, the mocking, the darkness, the ripping of the temple veil, Jesus' words, and finally, Jesus' burial, and then 3 days later, his resurrection. So, a quick tour of Jesus' public ministry and how some of the events fit together. Not the end, because Jesus lives. He rose from the dead and has ascended into heaven.